hung in sedate silence in the void, clouds of ice and gas and frozen flotsam sparkling in the light of the distant sun. The only movement was the front half of a battleship, quickly identified as the Theseus from the size of the dorsal lance turrets, which was turning slowly as its floors vented the last of its internal atmosphere. The majestic battleships and cruisers had been torn apart. Their escorts clung to them like piglets about their sow, but they too were frozen and still and dead. The Lord Lieutenant Beric pushed on through the iron corpses, leading the small flotilla of survivors through the debris field. The sight of Agrippina killed any hope that they might have held onto. The planet, a grey ball of forge-world ash and pollution, was now a vast black comet, circling slowly in its orbit, a long tail of rock smoke and debris falling behind it. There was a stunned silence on the bridge of the Lord Lieutenant Beric. "Agrippina too," someone said. No one responded. "Our enemies seem to have foreseen our every move," Gruber said. Again, no one spoke. At last, Gruber said, "Say nothing of this, nothing at all. Communicate that to the other captains. The men cannot know. They have to have hope." He looked at each of his commanders in turn. "Understood?" They nodded solemnly. Chapter 2. Debris Field, Agrippina Sector. There was silence aboard the Sons of Malice cruiser, the Bronze Minos. The figures in the bridge wore archaic power armour of black and white quarters with trims of brass spikes. They were still as shadows as they stood waiting, and at last a figure moved on the bridge. No one stirred as the newcomer spoke in a low hiss of fangs.
"Agitor."
"Yes, Janga."
"We have identified the ships."
There was a pause before the adjutant nodded.
"Speak."
"The ships are from Cadia."
The words had a heavy import, and Junga let them fall before saying anything more. The adjutant smiled.
"Abaddon's net was not as tight as he promised us."
"No, Lord. These are Cadians."
The adjutant paused. He did not turn from the viewscreen and spoke in a whisper.
"So, Younger, this is all that remains of Cadia's proud armies. A handful of hulks."
"Yes, Adjutor."
This time, the adjutor gave a low chuckle. The sudden noise surprised some of the other figures standing there.
"So, the chance has been given to us to destroy the Sons of Cadia. How could I let this moment pass? When we wipe them out, will they understand the delightful irony of this moment?"
"I doubt it. What do they know? They learn nothing that is true. They will have no idea about us, about the past, about the blood debt they owe us."
"They won't, will they? It's almost sad. Perhaps we should let them know."
Junga frowned.
"They would not believe it. We did not remember until our eyes were opened."
The adjutant mused on this.
"We should just kill them," Junga said.
The adjutant nodded.
"You are right."
The name of the Sons of Malice chapter had long since been erased from Imperial records, but they had been loyal once. They were one of the 20 chapters known as the Astartes Praeses, chapters devoted to keeping the Cadian Gate secure. For centuries they had waged a tough and relentless war against the heretics and demons of the Eye of Terror. The ferocious manner of war-making became a byword for the ruthless and relentless punishment of treachery and heresy, and they prided themselves on the cost they inflicted upon their foes, taking recruits from their homeworld, Skelus, where tattooed tribes indulged in cannibalism. It was after millennia of devoted battle that an imperial inquisitor, Solomon Pietus, had witnessed the manner of their flesh-eating ceremonies. Instinct told him that the chapter had already fallen, and he had brought in a strike attack of Sisters of Our Martyred Lady and 5 regiments of Imperial Guard. The combined force caught the Sons of Malice in one of their 11-year rites when their guard was down. They attacked the chapter with melter and fire and fury. The attack failed utterly. Solomon Pietus was captured and sacrificed in the chapter's inner chambers, and as word arrived at the High Lords of Terror, the Sons of Malice were offered the chance to repair their sins with a 50-year crusade. The chapter master had refused. He would accept neither censure nor punishment, but he was a warrior with his own sense of honour. The imperial envoy was allowed to depart unscathed, the low hiss of the chapter master's defiance ringing in his ears.
"We have done nothing wrong," he had told him. "We shall not do penance to any."
It was a misconception that battles were won by strength or power or ferocity. It was certainly something that the chapter master of the Sons of Malice believed, typical of a gene-enhanced member of the Adeptus Astartes. But students of imperial history knew that martial strength did not decide the victors. In ancient times, a snowstorm or inclement weather might have tilted the balance of battle. The victors were often decided by small, incidental facts. And in the case of the struggle between the Inquisitor Solomon Pietus and the Sons of Malice, it was the Inquisitor's message that arrived at Holy Terror first. The Sons of Malice assumed that their long history of service to the Imperium would vindicate them of charges that they considered baseless. But the Inquisitor had sent urgent and skewed accounts to the High Lords of Terror, and with trouble so close to the Cadian Gate, the panicked response of the Imperium was swift and brutal and sudden. An extermination fleet arrived in the Skelis system within months. They would not listen to any of the Sons of Malice's brief messages. It was war. The Sons of Malice escaped aboard their battle barge, the Labyrinth, but they left their homeworld of feral tribesmen undefended, and it was on the feral world that the forces of Cadia descended, scouring the planet of human life in a terrible campaign of fire and murder. The chapter had been forced into the Eye of Terror. There they had fought both the heretics and the Imperium, until at last Abaddon had brought them round to his cause. Despite centuries of heresy, the injustice of their treatment had burned within them. After centuries of fighting and struggle, they had, through stupidity and alarm, been driven into the arms of the enemy whom they had been created to defeat. The chapter had chafed for centuries, and it seemed now that they had been given a chance to punish the Cadians for the role that they had played in their ancient tragedy. All this was known to the warriors who stood on that bridge. Ajita Kanath closed his eyes and said a silent prayer of thanks to the power of lawlessness and violence.
"Fate is kind to those who hate," the Ajita said. "They destroyed the tribes who were our mother and father. We shall destroy them and eat their souls."
But it was not just the Sons of Malice who had heard the rumours. All across the Agrippina sector, rumour flew. From the vapour world of Yamar to the subterranean hives of Narsine, heretical warbands of traitor Astartes gathered like carrion, determined to take their share of whatever glory was on offer. Word travelled quickly through the warp. Demons brought their mortal worshippers into the secret, and across the whole sector of what had once been imperial space, the agri-world of Alberturn, the island hives of Tabor, the grox-raising plains of Sarlax, from Lelithar, the penal worlds of Bar-El, and from proud Malin's Reach, shards of the Black Legion began to gather like vultures who see an old and dying beast fall and struggle to rise. Chapter 3. Agrippina Sector. On the bridge of the Lord Lieutenant Beric, the alarm bell started moments before the troop sender Spear of Aegeus exploded. Captain Zabusco scrolled through the readouts.
What happened?
He knew the captain of that craft well.
Plasma reactor overload, one of the flight crew suggested.
But then the first lance shots flared out, hitting the next ship, the Lady of Gygax, in her exposed belly.
Raise void shields, Captain Sabusko ordered. Now!
One by one, the surviving ships of the evacuation fleet got their void shields up. While the spear of Aegeus burned, the captain of the Lady of Gygax ran through the emergency protocols in an effort to save his ship. She had suffered critical hull ruptures on 3 troop levels. The ship would be lost entirely unless her captain took drastic action. He did not hesitate in opening each of his void gates. The void sucked out the contents of the chambers. In the space of 2 minutes, 7,000 veterans of Cadia Tertius were expelled out into the freezing void. Those that forgot to exhale popped like human balloons. They died more quickly. The others swelled as the water in their skin and muscles evaporated. They lost consciousness. Within 2 minutes, all of them were dead. The transport Imperius George was hit by a torpedo in the Engineerium, rendering the slender lozenge of a craft powerless as the Sons of Malice battle barge, the Bronze Minos, moved alongside. In a colossal broadside, the Space Marines of the Sons of Malice vented centuries of hatred on the defenseless warriors of 17 surviving regiments of Cadians aboard the Imperius George. The venerable warrior followed the Lord Lieutenant Beric as they accelerated away, but there was no way that the slow transports could outrun a strike cruiser of the Renegade Astartes. Gruber summoned Lord Navigator Hippolytus. The abhuman limped into the room with his 2 rattling attendants. Gruber explained the situation. Was he well enough to take them to Terra?
The warp will not be any kinder to us than it was last time.
You do not think we would survive the jump?
I guarantee we would not.
And we have no hope of reaching Terra?
In these storms, no.
Can we fight them off?
Gruber asked Sabusko. The ship's captain shook his head at even the idea of it.
There is no way. Can we board them?
The captain laughed.
We have no boarders, only landers.
Are the landers equipped with boarding devices?
Sabusko shook his head. Gruber's Cadian training told him to make the jump, to attack, to stand and fight and to sacrifice his men.
We could board them via the landing bays. It would be suicide. Their attack craft would destroy us before we even got close.
Gruber leaned on the back of the captain's chair. Well, it seems we have no choice. Gruber closed his eyes. He could see Creed's face in his mind's eye, unshaven, the smell of his morning shot of Amasek on his breath, his lip curled into a sneer as he listened to the older general speak. That was what an old general would do, he told himself. He put his fingers to his forehead and tried to force the ghost of Creed to speak. Alarms rang as Gruber stood with his eyes closed. The enemy was closing. At last, Gruber spoke.
Do you know this system, Captain?
Captain Sabusko shook his head.
I have not been to the Agrippina system before, he said.
Anyone else?
A naval sub-lieutenant stepped forward. He wore the black velvet greatcoat of Battlefleet Cadia, gold embroidery about his cuffs, and a pair of heirloom las pistols on his left hip.
Sir, my name is Lieutenant Denyam. I know the system well. I served for 10 years at Orant. I was an officer cadet on a Prometheum hauler, the Maya Hope.
Good man. Come here.
Gruber spelled out what he needed, and the younger man nodded.
If that is what you want, he said, then the best place would be here.
He put his finger to a point on the system charts. It was a small moon in an elliptical orbit about Morton's Key, one of the inner planets of the Agrippina system.
Morton's Key has one moon, Faith's Anchorage, uninhabited beyond a few Prometheum mining facilities.
Ice world, Denyam said. It was Captain Zabusko who spoke.
If you land on Faith's Anchorage, I will try and draw them off.
Gruber listened to the captain's plan. Everything about it seemed crazy, but they had no more options before them. Gruber nodded.
Right, then that is it. You will bring us into low orbit and disembark as many troops as possible. As soon as the landers get us off, Zabasko, you will proceed at full speed. They will either have to engage us or follow you. If they do not follow me, they will destroy you, Zabusko said. Gruber nodded. Yes, they will. But then there is a chance that you can make it to Terra. Lalink stepped forward. General Gruber, you should accompany Zabusko to Terra. You want me to flee? Gruber asked. Lalink tried to explain his point, but Gruber cut him off. I would be mortified to leave you behind. Any of you. No. I shall stand and fight with you. And if it is our fate to be killed, then so be it. We shall console ourselves with the hope that word will reach Terra. There was a silence as his orders sank in. At last, Gruber looked up. The faces were all pale with concern. Those are my orders. Please broadcast them to the surviving ships. Captain Zabusko nodded. Orders were relayed down the vox tubes, and the stars in the viewport were starting to pan to the left as the Lord Lieutenant Beric changed course. Gruber drew his shoulders back and forced a smile. The end had come. On the ice moon of Faith's anchorage, Cadian High Command would make their last stand. Chapter 4. Faith's Anchorage. All ship charts were clear. There was only one recorded point of habitation on Faith's Anchorage, a small landing pad and habdom on the western ice caps, half a mile from a Promethean mining complex. Gruber examined the maps he had. They could be out of date, but they were all he had to go on. Hab blocks, minehead, landing zone, storerooms, kitchen block. In his mind, Gruber drew up rudimentary plans, turning the mining complex into a fortress. Despite repeated calls on open and encoded wavelengths, the outpost did not answer any requests for information regarding the current strength of the garrison, their supplies of food and equipment, nor any other ancillary details. We must assume there will be nothing, Gruber said as he put the map down. We must take all we need with us. The enemy was closing in, but the Cadians prepared with their customary efficiency, their tech priests stripping the Lord Lieutenant Beric and the venerable warrior of anything that they would need as the Lord Lieutenant Beric slipped into the gravity well of Faith's anchorage and powered down to disembark. It took less than 6 hours for all the troops to be ferried to the surface. They found that the base on Faith's anchorage had already been wiped out. The genitorium was burned out, the Arvaslighters had been melter-bombed, and the ice was littered with the bodies of the Promethean miners. Gruber was unperturbed. He had a Lehman Russ shove the wrecked landers into a rough wall of steel on the east side of the base, then set out his defence ring. Individual commanders took over their own sectors, setting up enfilading fields of fire, kill zones, and a series of fallback points. Gruber gave the place a cursory look. It seemed ironically fitting. A small, unknown outpost for the pride of Cadia to make their last stand. A trail of landers was ferrying his troops down to the moon. He did not know how many he could get onto the planet. He could even see the ungainly shapes of the Lord Lieutenant Beric and the venerable warrior. From here, each craft looked no bigger than the last joint of his little finger. A third of the way across the sky, the strike vessels of their pursuers were approaching. He used his scopes to view them. They looked like six lean snakes slithering towards their prey. As the Cadians put the last touches to the trenches and firing points, Gruber had the void shield raised about the base. There was a whine as the tech priests coaxed the genitorium to life. Then the void shield flickered and shimmered into being, a buzzing blue dome above them. If the enemy wanted to engage them, then they would have to come down to the surface and slog it out, toe to toe. It would bring the Lord Lieutenant Beric and the venerable warrior valuable time. The two ships had already disengaged, each heading in different directions. The venerable warrior was making straight for the outer system, its engines flaring blue plasma as they were driven to their utmost. Think they'll make it? Lalink said. I pray so, Gruber said. His heart began to sink when one of the strike cruisers peeled off from the gathering fleet and made to follow it. Half an hour later, there were distant flashes of lance fire.
Gruber took his scopes from Lalink. He was just in time to see the venerable warrior explode in a miniature firework. Gruber cursed under his breath. "There's always the Lord Lieutenant Beric," Lalink offered. "Zabuzko seems a good captain." "I pray so," Gruber said. The Lord Lieutenant Beric had taken an opposite course, flying close to Agrippina's son in an attempt to get lost on the augury scanners. As the chronometer ticked by, it seemed that the Lord Lieutenant Beric had escaped. But as night began to fall on Faith's anchorage, the soldiers that he had set to watch the skies reported that a larger craft had appeared to cut the Lord Lieutenant Beric off. "What craft? Let me see," Gruber said. They helped him find the spot. Gruber's augmetic eye focused on the shape of a new ship. It had to be a battle barge. "Could it be friendly?" Lalink asked. "It might be," Gruber said. But inside, he knew that the Lord Lieutenant Beric was doomed. Even here, it seemed, they were caught in a net of steel and fire, and despite their struggles, the enemy was slowly tightening the noose. They used scopes to track the path of the Lord Lieutenant Beric. It ran as close to the sun as it dared. "They're approaching firing range," one of his aides reported. "Go on," Gruber willed it, punching his thigh. But then his aide reported seeing a sudden flash. One of the ships was dead. All of them knew that it had to be the Lord Lieutenant Beric. "I think they tried to engage their Geller fields," Lalink said. "The reactor must have been damaged, or the Lord Navigator's strength failed. Either way, the Geller field reactor failed on transition." "All hands lost," Lalink nodded. Gruber accepted the news in stoic silence. Terror would never know what had happened on Cadia. Half an hour later, his scouts reported the first sighting of landers making their way down to the planet. "I should make a speech," Gruber said, "before the end." Lalink looked about and nodded. "Yes, it would make the men feel better, I'm sure."
Chapter 5. The Battle of Faith's Anchorage. Gruber had faced an orbital assault from renegade Astartes before, and knew what it would entail. War on all fronts at once. A blistering attack combined with overwhelming and simultaneous ground and air-based assaults, no doubt with precision strikes on key commanders via drop pod or Thunderhawk. He prepared as best he could in depth around the domed hab block. About it were walls of stacked containers, the kitchen block, a line of wrecked Arvis lighters. Heavy weapons teams dug foxholes. Any gaps were filled with Aegis lines and ice trenches that offered wide fields of enfilading fire. Gruber divided the command of the line into four. Each of his best commanders was put in charge of a quarter. They set up their own HQ bastions. Each of the bastions was independent of the others, so that if one should fall, the others would not be affected. Gruber set up his defence in the domed hab. He kept his tanks back in a central mobile reserve, while half his available bane blades were dug in as massive support bastions, ready to pummel the enemy with their devastating firepower. A hand-picked bodyguard of Cadian Kazrakin accompanied the general as he made his rounds of each of the points of defence. About half his forces had hostile environment suits. The rest made do with greatcoats and triple issue of Cadian drab, which sufficed. It was not as if the campaign would last that long, Gruber thought. Lalink was scanning the horizon with his scopes. "They're moving in," Lalink said as he faced north. Gruber gave the skyline a brief glance. He was not worried yet. "They're just taking their time," he said. "We'll know when the attack is coming." The first ranging shots came half an hour later, lance strikes from orbit hammering down. The first three hit the ice fields before the bastion. The superheated beams sent a gout of steam and ice up into the air. The fourth hit the void shield, and the air crackled with blue light, and then the shot was dissipated, and the void shield held. Gruber looked up and seemed satisfied. He hated the waiting. He just wanted the thing to start. It was easier to react than to kick one's heels. For 20 minutes, the strikers hovered overhead and pummeled the ice fields about them. Lalink seemed jubilant.
They're fools, he shouted over the din as the flat ice fields were churned up. They'll have to get through that.
Gruber put his hand on his sword hilt. That won't slow them down.
Lalink didn't understand.
Gruber pointed.
They're giving themselves cover.
Lalink looked again and saw the flat kill zones were now a confused landscape of ice and crater fields. At that moment, a thin white cloud appeared in the blue of the sky above them. Within seconds, there were 15, 20 contrails arrowing down towards them.
Gruber nodded to Lalink, and the alarm was sounded. Orders repeated, prayers said to the Golden Throne. Cadia stands! Gruber shouted, and the war cry was echoed from trench to trench as the hydras and saber weapon platforms opened up with streams of tracers, burning liquid red lines into the sky. A thrill went through the thousands of guardsmen. After 100 days in the burning hell of Cadia, Faith's anchorage seemed hard but clean. The first drop pods impacted. As the petal doors slammed down, a hail of missiles and bolter fire hosed out in all directions. The effect on the Cadians was minimal, but it forced them to keep their heads down as the second wave of drop pods hit. And this time, the giant figures of Renegade Astartes leapt out in their suits of power armor, their once proud livery of black and white quarters now defaced with heretical symbols and carvings. Sanction Psyker Rutt stood with command squad of 5th Bastion on the north side of the base. Behind them sat the metal bulk of the Baneblade Pugilist. Rutt could feel the fear of the men, the anticipation of battle. It was a heady, almost overpowering sensation as the psychic tension rose to ultimate pitches. And then the shooting started, and he felt the relief and focus of the men about him start to tingle in his toes and fingertips.
Are you well? Ivan said.
Well, Rutt responded. Ivan nodded. It was his job to shoot Rutt should the psyker show signs of corruption. Ivan had shot 2 of the last 3 psykers he'd been assigned to. It was good practice to check in regularly. Corruption could come almost instantaneously. If in doubt, his instructor had always told him, shoot.
Do you have faith?
Ivan said. Rutt swayed.
Faith in the Emperor,
he responded, as he felt the wave of psychic power building in him. The natural instinct of an untrained mind was to unleash one's powers the minute a target presented itself. But Imperial Sanction Psykers were not like wild men and shamans. They were as well honed as a standard issue bayonet, as well disciplined as the troops they served with. The shooting grew closer. Rutt groaned as he held his power back inside him. A drop pod hit 50 yards to his left, the superheated metal melting a hole in the ice as the assault ramp slammed down. In an instant, there was a furious firefight as the men and women of Cadia unleashed all they had on the warriors within. A storm of lasbolts and heavy bolter rounds pummeled the drop pod openings, but despite it all, from the steam and smoke and fumes, 10 power-armored figures leapt out. One landed in a trenchwork, his upper torso visible, as he slaughtered the unseen guardsmen within. Another swung his flamer in a low, wide arc, incinerating more Cadians. A third knelt and singled out the Bastion's commander from his shoulder epaulets.
Sir, look out!
One of the command squad shouted, pushing the captain sideways, and the round hit the man behind him, spraying red across the back of the trench. The Baneblade Macarius Star covered the southern approaches, where the men of the combined 34th, 98th, 664th, and 2003rd Cadians drove the attacking traitor marines back into the crater fields. A ferocious firefight strobed the ice. As the Cadians' heavy weapons team were engaged, the tanks of the enemy rolled forward.
Predator!
The chief gunner Ruslan reported. He could see its turret just peeking over an ice shelf, the twinned las cannons traversing as it lined up a shot at them.
Crack!
He ordered, and the long, pointed anti-tank shell was slid into the breech of the Baneblade's main battle cannon. There was a slam of metal and the low squeak of the locking mechanism, and then he fired. The whole tank shook with the recoil. It took a moment for him to zero in again. The shell had taken the top off the ice bank, but it looked like the enemy vehicle had escaped. He panned round, looking for another target, as the foredeck demolisher cannon fired and the foregunner team whooped.
Got them!
Yuri shouted.
Well done,
Roslin called down to him. Yuri had started the war as a powder boy, and now he was a better gunner than Roslin himself. As long as he kept his cool.
Look for the next one now. Keep focused.
Roslin sighted a squadron of bikes racing towards them. There were three, the sidecar gunners engaging the bastion alongside them. The riders had not seen the Bane Blade's turret swing towards them. It was almost too easy.
Ready?
Roslin called. He was so eager for a kill.
Ready,
his team replied. Roslin did not wait for a second longer and fired. The recoil threw them back once more. The ice erupted in a blizzard of snow. When it cleared, there was a crater scattered with dark scraps of burning wreckage.
Kill, he confirmed. All three of them.
There was a cheer from the fore and aft gun teams.
About time you lot helped,
Daniel called out from the port sponson. His las cannon had been jamming on Cadia, and he'd spent the entire journey stripping the gun mountings down and fitting it all back together. Ruslan felt magnanimous now that he'd got his first kill in.
How's the las cannon moving?
He shouted as he panned for another target.
Very nicely,
Daniel called back. There was a flash as the las cannon fired.
You should ask that freckin' power armored giant, he said. Oh, but you can't. I just shot his head off.
Daniel swung his weapon mountings round, and then there was a sudden flash and a bang, and the chamber was filled with fumes.
What the hell?
Yuri shouted. But they all knew what had happened, even before the smoke cleared and Leonid pulled Daniel's body from his seat. Daniel's clothes were burned and smoking. His whole right side was red and raw, the skin burned away. He flopped sideways, his head chiming a low, dull note on the Bane Blade's metal hull.
Dead,
Leonid said. He dragged Daniel's body to the back by the magazine.
Did it overheat?
Ruslan called down, and Yuri bent and waved away the smoke. He saw the las cannon trigger at the same time that he saw the neat, round hole that had been blasted through the Bane Blade's 4-inch ceramite hull. He was about to speak when a grenade was thrown through the hole.
Grenade!
His shout gave everyone a moment's warning. It was not enough. The explosion filled the Bane Blade with a storm of metal fragments. The smoke was still clearing when Ruslan saw a leg. He had no idea if it was his. He was still dragging himself up from the floor when heavy footsteps rang out on the top of the tank. They seemed almost casual as they strode to the back of the great tank and then stopped. Ruslan suddenly understood. The figure was standing above the magazine. He panicked for a moment, then saw that his gun team had closed the magazine doors.
Thank the throne, he thought,
as the silence went on a few seconds longer. The magazine was heavily reinforced with layers of ceramite and ablative shielding. It would take the multi-melter tore through the inches of shielding as if they were wet paper. Macarius Star was the first Bane Blade to die that day. Sanction Psyker Rutt was crouching in the angle of the trench. He kept his head low. The air above him sizzled with ozone. Lasbolts hissed as they hit the snow. The bark of bolters was constant. His pistol remained holstered. His fingers tensed and stretched. He felt the power ready within him.
Where is your faith?
Ivan hissed. His mentor was just behind him.
In the Emperor,
Rutt said. He could feel them coming towards him. Cadians were backing down the trench, their las rifles at their shoulders, ready. Suddenly they flew backwards, mass reactive shells jerking their bodies like marionettes. The ice walls dripped with gobbets of human flesh. There was wet on Rutt's face. He wiped it off, saw blood on his sleeve. He had seen worse.
Ready?
Rutt said. Ivan nodded.
Right, Rutt said. Let's go for it.
The sanctioned psychers stepped forward. Down the stretch of the trench, a black and white armoured space marine was striding towards him. The trench reached only as high as his abdomen. In one fist he carried a massive bolter, a dripping chain axe in the other. The blade buzzed as he came towards Rutt. The look of the enemy was like that of a lion on its prey, taking in all that it needs to know in an instant. It lifted its bolt gun and pressed the trigger down long enough for three mass reactive bolts to fire. The spent brass shells flew left across the path of the Space Marine as the bolter exploded. It had taken just a finger of Rutt's psychic force to plug the barrel of the bolt gun. It was a trick he'd used before. Surprise gave him a moment's advantage. The Space Marine kept striding forward. If he was at all perturbed, he did not show it. He casually dropped his bolter, drew his bolt pistol, gunned his chain axe to full, and accelerated into a run. Rutt braced his feet into the trampled ice. He envisaged a fist of steel in the air about him. He put up a hand, closed his eyes, and sent that fist straight towards his foe. His power propelled it forward, as a breath of wind will lift a feather in the air and carry it along. It hit the renegade full in the chest, went straight through the power armor, bone, and one of its hearts, came out the other side and buried itself 30 feet into the ice. Rutt felt its power. He opened his eyes, saw the chain axe descend. Rutt's blood sprayed over Ivan's face as the minder fell over himself in horror. The Space Marine turned and caught him by the foot. Ivan kicked and squirmed. He fired his last pistol and hit. He must have hit, but the thing seemed immune. Thrown. It had a fist-shaped hole through its chest. Ivan thrashed as the Space Marine dragged him up to its helmet. It lifted him high enough to bring Ivan's face right up to the Space Marine's faceplate.
"Are you frightened, little man?" the renegade hissed in a voice that was chillingly quiet.
Ivan lost control of his bowels.
"How can you still live?"
he asked, staring at the gore that dripped from the hole in the thing's chest.
"Because I want vengeance," the Space Marine hissed.
And with a sudden jerk of his power-armored fist, he snapped Ivan's neck. Chapter 6. Gruber's Last Stand. On the west side of the base, where the kitchen block met the sunken Habs, the survivors of 15 regiments faced off against a horde of howling cultists and mech slaves that had been harvested from Agrippina's high forges when the planet had been destroyed. The cultists charged barefoot across the ice and were mown down as they caught on the lines of barbed wire. But they were just the first assault. Behind them came industrial mech slaves, pumped full of stims, their data coils replaced with a searing litany of heresy and chaos bile. It sent their lobotomized minds into a state of frenzy. A single platoon of Cadian shock troopers held the front trench. A Sons of Malice kill squad turned their flank, so they fell back to the Aegis defence line. The first line knelt as the second fired over their heads, and the third line reloaded. Their lieutenant had lost an arm on Cadia, but he taught himself to shoot left-handed.
"First rank!"
he shouted, and a salvo of shots stabbed out.
"Second rank!"
And again, the shot scythed into the enemy.
"Third rank!"
The mech slaves scrambled over the barbed wire. They leapt the front trench and charged towards the Aegis with all the ferocity of arco-flagellants. The men held their line.
"Fire at will!"
The order went out when the mech slaves were 20 feet off, and the lieutenant lowered his bolt pistol and fired, hitting one in the chest and blowing its frail factorum body apart. The first mech slave attacked the metal Aegis, its buzzsaw throwing yellow sparks into the air. A last round to the heart stilled the thing, but more of them were gaining the line. The Cadians were mowing the insane creatures down, but it was not enough. Even the wounded bounded and skidded on their own entrails. Only death could stop them. They came forward in a blizzard of razor scythes, forge hammers and pain lashes. The line of Cadians held firm. Not one man flinched, even as the tide of mech slaves tore into them, and the first, second, and third lines disappeared in a spray of red. On the east side of the compound, the line of wrecked Arvus lighters gave the heavy weapons teams a broad field of fire over the top of the trench and defence line networks. There, the elite Cadians drove the assault back 3 times, leaving a field of burning tanks and dying cultists. As the day wore on, the enemy withdrew, but none of the Cadians was fooled. The heretics had just been testing them. Now they knew their strengths and weaknesses. The Sons of Malice had bidden their time. They launched their assault under cover of dark, an armoured spearhead plunging straight over the trenches on the west side, right up to the line of stacked containers. The heretic tanks mowed heavy weapon squads down beneath their tracks, while stragglers were cut down with chainsaw and axe before lasbolts drove them back. The surviving Cadians were pushed back towards the central habs, where Gruber stood, sword in hand.
"We cannot hold!"
Lalink shouted. His left arm was in a crude sling, but he'd drawn his chainsaw.
"We will hold,"
Gruber told him, but he'd known that this moment would come.
"To me!"
he shouted, and gathered his Khazrakin about him. In the darkness, the lasbolts flashed. Gruber marched out, bellowing the war cry.
"Cadia stands!"
The Khazrakin shielded the body of General Gruber with their own. Their hellguns flashed a bright orange, but many of them were armed with plasma and melter. Their unerring aim punished the enemy. When the cultists charged, they were met with a wall of flame. The Khazrakin held their ground as the fiercest made it to their line. There was a furious hand-to-hand struggle, a brutal combat decided by bayonets and knives, rifle butts and courage. After what seemed an age, the cultists withdrew, dragging their wounded with them.
"Have we won?"
someone asked, confused. Gruber laughed.
"Not until we've killed the renegade Astartes. Until we meet them, there will be no victory."
As the dawn came, the survivors could see the cost of the night's fighting. The western defences had been overrun, the trenches filled with the bodies of their enemies. Gruber reorganised his defences. The doorways of the central hab were barricaded, each room and window made defensible. The cultist attacks came again and again, interspersed with bombardment from space. The void shield lasted for 2 days before the generator overheated, and there was nothing the tech priests could do. Then, the base was subjected to a maelstrom of lance and bombardment cannon. At the same time, waves of cultists charged against them. Mist rose as the bombardment melted the ice. When it seemed that there was nothing worse to come, the onslaught ended, and the handful of stunned and scattered survivors crawled out of the ruins of the hab block and trenches, looked skywards and saw, in all its terror and magnificence, another orbital assault. Chaos warbands that had been scouring the Agrippina sector flocked to Faith's anchorage, eager to take their share in the spoils. They all joined in the attack. They came in drop pods and thunderhawks and more ancient craft of brass and black ceramite. There were warbands from the Sons of Slaughter, the Black Legion, Crimson Slaughter, and 5 other legions. This time, there was no counterfire. The Hydra gun platforms were in ruin. The Bane Blades had been destroyed. The survivors of Cadia, dead. The assembled warbands strode forward in their armour of black and brass, blue and gold, dripping red, black and white. They were here to witness and celebrate 10,000 years of struggle. It was a warrior from the Sons of Malice who singled General Gruber out. The Space Marine pointed with one hand, while from his other shoulder a black, suckered tentacle flicked about it, like the twitch of an irritated feline.
"Cadian," he called out. "It is not too late to turn."
Its tentacle made a gesture of taking in the assembled ring of Chaos Space Marines about them.
"We all started as you, defending the false Emperor. If you renounce your vows, I will spare you."
General Gruber stumbled to his feet. His voice was clear and strong, despite the gashes that had been torn through his breastplate. He ignited his power sword as the dreadful monster strode towards him.
"Never!"
he shouted as he charged. Chapter 7. Pax Imperialis. General Benedict stood with Admiral D'Armitage on the bridge of the Emperor-class battleship Pax Imperialis and countered the enemy craft that ringed Faith's anchorage. There were 5 strike cruisers in the assorted colours of renegade space marines, a black battle barge, and a number of modified escorts, their proud heraldry now defaced with the symbols of heresy.
"Can we take them?"
Benedict asked. The Admiral pursed his lips and nodded.
"Yes," he said. "I believe we can."
Benedict felt a wave of responsibility upon his shoulders. He took in a deep breath and thought of all the other commanders who might be here, but most of all, of Creed. His loss had been the most grievous. Benedict was unworthy to lead the forces of Cadia, but there was no one left. Good, he said. Then let the attack begin. Without a navigator as able as Hippolytus Frem, the evacuation fleet and surviving ships of Battlefleet Cadia had been scattered across the galaxy by the warp. About half had followed in the wake of the Lord Lieutenant Beric, re-entering real space in the far reaches of the Agrippina system. The wounded ships had gathered well beyond the elliptical orbit of far-flung Urath and the labour-rich Narsine, and proceeded cautiously into the system. Admiral D'Armitage had imposed strict silence on all ships and crews, as his damaged craft went through necessary repairs and refitting. As soon as his Cobra scouts had reported a gathering of heretical ships within the order of Agrippina and Morton's Quay, he'd ordered his fleet to move forward at dead slow and to maintain void silence. By the time D'Armitage and Benedict were surveying the Chaos fleet, a lifetime of training had reasserted itself, and the forces of Cadia were eager for another fight, a chance to prove themselves. Benedict would give them that, he promised. The Grand Alliance led Battlefleet Cadia forward, her entire complement of fighters and bombers sitting on the flight decks ready to go. The heretic ships had been so focused on destroying Gruber that they only suddenly saw, with horror and alarm, that another, much larger Cadian fleet was sailing towards them. On each bridge, the heretic skeleton crews left behind were presented with a desperate challenge: to engage or to flee. Each of the captains on board responded according to their own priorities. For some, it was a chance to seize control of a valuable void craft. Others saw the Imperial fleet and knew that the forces that had met on the ice world of Faith's anchorage would be lost without them. But none of the choices were good. It was just a matter of picking the least worst from a range of options. The Hades-class heavy cruiser, Tears of Hate, jabbed forward, attempting to engage the lead Imperial ships with her deadly broadsides and slow them down. Her slave gun crews were hauling the last of her vast shells into the breach when she was struck squarely on the armor-plated nose by a Nova cannon shot from the Golden Farrell, a Luna-class cruiser. The shot detonated with incredible power, ripping the Tears of Hate apart. In an instant, 9,000 lives were lost. Black Legion, heretics, cultists, and slaves. The Void did not care. As the two fleets closed, the heretics began to exact a growing toll on the weakened Imperial craft. Assault torpedoes were launched across the Void with Cadians storming Chaos ships and Black Legion kill squads, fighting their way through to the Engineariums, bridges, and Void Shield generators, and disabling them with a series of well-laid melter bombs. The skies above the small moon were thick with flashes of fire and smoke as debris began to rain down on Faith's anchorage. In the midst of it all, the Grand Alliance's flight crews tore gaping holes in the enemy craft, but she herself was raked by a pair of broadsides that left her listing to port, unable to steer. Her course drove her straight into the middle of the Chaos fleet, where she was set upon with merciless fury. There were fights in almost every landing bay as the heretics sought to seize control of the Imperial flagship. It was only the sudden intervention of a lean, grey hunter that saved her. Where the Space Wolf strike cruiser Stiklestad came from, no one could tell. But suddenly she appeared between the two ships and took a broadside that was meant to finish off the Grand Alliance on her void shields, and then retorted with a broadside of her own, crippling the burning Slaughter-class cruiser, the Hand of Abaddon. The battle was deadly and bloody. Bit by bit, the Chaos fleet was broken, destroyed, or boarded, the few survivors fleeing sunwards, late arrivals quickly turning back. After 8 hours of relentless naval fighting, the Chaos forces on Faith's anchorage faced the same predicament that Gruber's small force had before them. The Imperials held the space above them, and Faith's anchorage was to be their grave. Admiral D'Armitage led his fleet forward, and they unleashed a devastating barrage on the moon.
"We could destroy it," he said,
as the green light of the holo-pict underlit his face.
"Don't,"
Bendix said. Allow my men the opportunity to take revenge. How many do you have? Bendix paused.
Enough, he said.
Think you could take out the forces on the moon? Bendix smiled.
I'm sure of it.
Darmitage bowed. General Bendix, my landers are at your disposal. Take revenge for us all. Chapter 8. New Cadia. It took 2 weeks for the Cadian shock troopers under Bendix's command to scour Faith's anchorage clear of any heretic trace. General Gruber's body was found, and he was buried in a colossal marble mausoleum. All the defenders of Faith's anchorage laid out in a neat, starlit graveyard about him. 3 Cobras were selected to make the journey to Holy Terra, to bring news of the Cadian Gate's fall, while planet by planet, the whole Agrippina system was cleansed of the enemy. The naval facilities of Orant and Morton's Quay were returned to production, and the proud ships of Battlefleet Cadia were brought back to full strength. Bendix let it be known that Kairos, the 7th planet in the system, would henceforth be known as New Cadia. The Space Wolves of the Stiklestad did not help in this effort, but they did send a lander across to the Grand Alliance, a sleek, grey arrow that filled the main landing bay on the lower port side. Once the ship was near docking, General Bendix and Admiral Armitage came down to meet it. Neither of them felt entirely comfortable. The Space Wolves had a certain reputation, and a human could not meet a member of the Adeptus Astartes without a tremor of fear running through them, especially after the last months, when they had faced the terror of space marines who had lost their way. The Space Wolves' Thunderhawk slowly filled the rectangular mouth of the landing bay, and seemed to barely scrape inside. It touched down with a hiss as the incredible weight of the craft settled slowly on the dampeners. The loading ramps lowered, and then the carriage clamps disengaged, and the Thunderhawk began to rise into the air, leaving a cargo container behind. Darmitage and Bendix exchanged glances as the Thunderhawk turned and powered out of the landing bay.
Is it safe? Darmitage demanded.
Bendix ordered his Kazrakin squad forward to investigate, but as they approached it, 2 figures appeared from behind the cargo container. They were both dressed in Cadian drab.
Captain Rath Sturm, the first declared, as he made the sign of the Aquila. Last surviving member of the Cadian 94th, Kazrakin, the Brothers of Death.
Bendix saluted and turned to the girl.
White Shield Arminka Lesk, Kaza Myrak Defence Force.
The Space Wolves carried you from the planet? Bendix asked. It was the girl who spoke.
Yes, sir.
And they brought you here? The 2 soldiers nodded, and the girl said,
Sir, Lord General, there is something we must show you. She led him to the back of the vast container. From inside came the scent of earth and rock.
Bendix looked at the thing that lay cushioned there. It was grey and smooth and riddled with holes. It was intimately familiar to anyone who had been on Cadia.
Impossible, Bendix said.
But he stepped up onto the ramp, walked inside, and put his hand to its side. The stone was dead and cold and still, but it was from Cadia.
You brought a pylon from Cadia, Bendix said.
They nodded.
Yes, sir.
We must make a memorial of it, he said. We must never forget where we came from.
Minka nodded. Her eyes were hard.
Never, she promised him.
Never.
Epilogue. Pax Imperialis. Minka sits on her bunk and turns her white shield helmet in her hands. In a ceremony this morning, she was promoted with the other surviving cadets. She is a Cadian shock trooper, even though her planet no longer exists. They are veteran warriors on course for Holy Terra. This is all she had ever wanted, she thinks, as the troop ship prepares to enter the warp, to leave home, to graduate from the cadets, to fight for the Emperor. The iron bulkheads rattle as the Gellerfield generator powers up. A low whine fills the troop hangar. Rath is lying on the bunk above her. He is smoking a law stick. The metal bed creaks as he turns over. He peers down, his augmetic eye glowing red.
Get some sleep, he says.
She nods.
How long will it take?
His head appears again.
What?
The transition?
Wrath laughs.
Who knows, he says, lying back. We might never get there.
Minka knows they will. She lies back and closes her eyes, and for a moment she is a child again, staring into the eye of terror. Her father holds her up, and she shouts at the sky, and the moment is over. He puts her back down, puts his hand on her shoulders, and kisses her head.
Do you have faith, my child?
She nods.
Say it,
he urges. She speaks the words.
I have faith in the Emperor.
Minka opens her eyes. She has seen the saint. She has faith. They will reach Holy Terra.
We'll get there, she says.
Wrath says nothing for a while. He takes another law stick from his breast pocket and lights it, puffs blue smoke into the air, takes a drag.
Great, he says at last.
Minka lies back as the alarms begin to ring. There is a lurch as the ship transits into the warp, and she feels bile rise and swallows it back. It is just warp sickness. It'll pass. In a month or two, they will arrive at the center of the Imperium of Man. A battle has been lost, but the fight will still go on. She stares up at the bunk above her, where Wrath's shape is imprinted through the mattress. Minka looks to the future. She sees only war. That was Cadia Stands by Justin D. Hill, read by David Seddon. This recording is copyrighted to Games Workshop 2019.
Audible hopes you've enjoyed this programme.